It's 11:12 in the morning. Today is Thursday, December 6th, 2018. Hi, it's John Williams. This is The Missing Rascals, a weekly podcast we record at the studios of WGN Radio in Chicago. We appreciate your finding the podcast. Remember, you can find my show weekdays from 1 to 3 on WGN and Saturdays from 10 to noon.
I'm Steve Bertrand, host of The Business Lunch on WGN Radio.
I'm Justin Kaufman, co-host of Steve Cochran's show on WGN Radio and the Download with Justin Kaufman podcast.
I'm Eric Zorn, the gentlemanly columnist from the Tribune. Wednesdays, Fridays, yeah. Sundays.
He reminds me of a different era. Yes. Doesn't he? Yeah.
Back when columnists were friendly and
had to use a ruler
across the aisle.
Use a ruler to see how much space was being taken out with the copy edit.
We'll get to Bush's funeral and how that was handled in just a minute. I think that's what Eric is already doing. Hey, listen, we so appreciate you listening to this podcast. We want you to be part of it. So please leave a voice message that we can play back, a question or a comment. Or Eric would just be happy if, as you may know, at the end of these podcasts, we do our recommendations. You would send us a recommendation. Eric has, in fact, been voice messaging his recommendation to the podcast, even though he sits here in the podcast.
I like to get things taken care of early, and that's one of the things. It's like Christmas shopping. I got it done early. So,
yeah.
My recommendation, Elif already has my recommendation. She's going to drop it in.
So when you hear us all do ours at the end, you'll actually be hearing Eric do what you could do, and that is, hey, send us your recommendation, something you're reading, watching, listening to, eating, drinking. It can be anything. Recommendation. You know what one of my recommendations is? I put it on Facebook.
Don't do this because I never get a chance to give mine. I really want
well,
to.
Now you have your chance. You can do it by voicemail.
Holiday puzzles.
No, not
we put
phone,
a holiday puzzle
message
out. The joy of a good puzzle during the holidays when you're sitting there with a little something. What a nice thing to do.
My family's really into this. They put puzzles out on tables and they make them. Yeah.
I'm very good at starting puzzles.
Do you do the edges and then you like walk away?
I do some of the edges.
Some of the edges.
Steve, do you have a recommendation?
The movie Green Book. Did you see Justin?
I love it. I cried at the trailer.
It's just
the trailer.
Mahershala Ali and the other guy,
Viggo Mortensen.
Viggo Mortensen, and it's a movie set in the '60s, early '60s. Ali plays a pianist, and Mortensen is his mobbed up sort of driver who takes him through the South. It's just a beautiful movie, and it's a stark retelling of what African American black people went through traveling through the South in those days. But man, it's the best movie I've seen by far.
I haven't seen it. A friend of mine did and emailed me this week and said best movie he has seen, and he can't remember.
Can I just say Green Book refers to there was a book published by a black man that listed hotels where African Americans could stay in the South. And it was called The Green Book. So Ali's being driven around, and while his driver, the mob guy, can stay in a nice hotel anywhere in the South, he's staying in these ramshackle places.
Why don't you do yours?
I'll do mine. I'll do the HBO documentary, The Price of Everything. Have you seen this about the contemporary art world? Did you see it's great.
I have seen this. It's terrific. And there's a Chicago art collector.
Stefan Edlis.
Yeah, who spends hundreds of millions of dollars supporting art.
And he has a pile of lemons in the corner of his office. And the pile of lemons is modern
art.
It's
a little old. You got to find it. It's probably 2-3 weeks old now. But I enjoyed the heck out of it. I watched it last weekend, and I just thought that world of how much art costs and what happens to the actual artists in those scenarios. There's a great scene in the movie where the artist is watching on a Skype, on a Sotheby's
auction,
and they sell it for $900,000, and she's nonplussed.
She's like, going to change her life.
You think it's going to change her life? She's like, eh. She's like, that's a flip. Somebody bought that from me and now is flipping it again and flipping it again. They don't even actually own their art.
If I hadn't submitted my recommendation already, I would just add my voice to Justin's, but I have submitted my own. So.
Kind of a bitch, isn't it, Eric? Because now you can't play.
The early bird gets left behind.
I won't do this line justice, or maybe even how it impacted me, but in that movie, the line that jumped out was where somebody said that if you don't value literally art, then society doesn't preserve and protect it. If we all think it's crazy to spend that much money on a work of art, and we kind of do, if somebody wasn't willing to do it, then it would fall into disrepair. It wouldn't be valued. It wouldn't be in museums. We wouldn't continue to have art. So somebody's got to spend millions of dollars on these things.
There's a middle ground between spending millions of dollars for a pile of lemons and and supporting artists who do really inventive and intriguing work. So I don't know. I mean, I think it doesn't have to be as crazy as it is. And this movie establishes that it is fairly crazy.
I can't wait to hear your recommendation, Eric, but I'm going to have to wait.
We're going to have to wait.
Wait. wait until the podcast launches.
State funeral service for George H.W. Bush went as well as possible. Everyone who spoke, spoke eloquently. Everyone who sang, sang well. The setting, the Washington National Cathedral's magnificent. It was a tribute fit not just for a president, but for an era. In eulogizing his father, George W. paid tribute to a kinder and gentler and wiser America. President Trump shook hands with the Obamas. He avoided the gaze of Bill Clinton. Hillary Clinton looked dead ahead. Talk to me, guys, about the performances, the body language, and what you took away. Steve, you go first from that service.
You know, I was just saying this morning in the newsroom, the funeral in Houston is going on as we speak, and it was striking to me how George Bush, George W. Bush, was the guy reaching out, the guy shaking hands, the guy, you know, he did it when he came into the Episcopal Church in Houston today. Jeb walked, you know, wasn't the one. It was the, as ebullient is the word, I don't know, that George W. And, you know, I don't know if that speaks to the fact that he's the oldest or if it speaks to the fact that he was the most successful politician.
Maybe it's rank, yeah, I don't know.
I don't know, but it was pretty clear that he was the guy who was reaching out as much as people were reaching out to
him. I noticed that at the state funeral, too, that W. walked over and handed a mint to Michelle and Glad handed the other presidents. And I don't think it would have been inappropriate for any of the other siblings to do that, but they didn't. They did not.
Right.
Yeah. It was an incredibly amusing little moment, right, where he hands Michelle Obama a mint and she
I missed that.
She
and
laughs.
What a shot, too. I mean, just they kept going back to the shot of Trump, Melania, Barack, Michelle, Bill, Hillary, like that whole, you know, even Jimmy Carter and Rosalynn Carter on the end, that shot, that cutaway shot during the event to see all of those political power players sitting next to each other. I thought it was amazing.
You didn't think that was heavy-handed? No.
No, I thought it was what you're supposed to do, right? You're eulogizing and you're paying respects to a former president.
I was thinking there were five former presidents there, correct? Five?
Yeah. It's rare that you have that many alive. Yeah.
Now, my issue with the whole story of George H.W. Bush, I had somebody stop me and just talk about how there seems to be some eventual, it's obvious that someone dies, but the eventual whitewashing of history, that H.W. wasn't the greatest president and the most dignified and the most class, you know, everyone talks about how great and classy he was. But, you know, there's a lot of social issues, domestic issues that either he was at the table for, that anti-gay comes to mind, and how they handled the AIDS HIV crisis.
Clarence Rodney Thomas, King, for God's sake.
Rodney King was in H.W. Bush's time. There's a lot of things that just kind of get omitted from the obit, if you will, or at least the conversation we're having about the Bush legacy.
Well, I think that this has really been exacerbated by how this death, this funeral, is comprehensive rebuke to Donald Trump. And so that in order to magnify that, you magnify his virtues. You say, this is a guy, and even, you know, nobody mentioned Trump in the eulogies yesterday, but he was like the subtext of all of it.
But didn't they? Right, exactly.
And so you talk about, this is a man who was, you know, good-natured, who didn't let hate get the best of him, who, you know, on and on, just about everybody, you just kept hearing the undertone of criticism of Trump. And, you know, he's probably too obtuse to have gotten that, but I think the country did, and the same thing happened. The thing was, it was more blatant than the McCain funeral, but we've seen, I was glad
that W did not go all Meghan McCain, aren't you?
You know what, I think I understand. I get your point, and your point rings true, but I think they would have said those things had Hillary Clinton been president. You know, I think they probably would have said those same things about Bush. Had Trump not been in the room,
they would have felt different.
They might have said the same things, but I think that, but the context really makes those land harder. And I think that gets back to what Justin was saying. I think it's one of the reasons why everyone is forgetting about George, the things that George Bush did, the Willie Horton ad, the way he flip flopped on abortion, the thing he was. Not a perfect man. He never claimed to be a perfect man, but we have this tendency when famous people die, to forget all the things that they did.
I sure as hell hope when I die that people focus on the good things, because...
Oh, I don't think that's going to happen.
Yeah, but I think that this version of this, right, is what we needed to hear right now. I mean, you know, the Bushes can orchestrate their father's funeral any way they want, and as a nation, I'm aware of these things you two are talking about, but I don't think I was pining for that or saying, hey, wait a minute,
well,
this is a
whitewash. Maybe not during state funeral coverage, but the days before, the two, 3 days before,
this week
today,
doesn't
I don't
bother
hear
me.
Any of it, man.
Do you really feel that itch?
No, but
it needs to be scratched?
I honor, and watching the state funeral, I had patriotism to watch how this was playing out, and it was really touching, and I thought that his son did a great job. But I also recognize that, you know, when we talk about legacy, we like to, and I think Eric hit it on the head, because of Trump, we're talking about this guy's legacy as if he was the best leader we've ever had,
I'm glad.
Two things, and I'm going to contradict my own reaction with Justin a little bit, but I learned today, and maybe you guys already know this, that John Meacham, who you've talked to, I've talked to, and Brian Mulroney, the former Canadian Prime Minister, each delivered in person their eulogies to President Bush while he was alive.
Oh, my gosh.
Isn't that nice?
That's great.
Yeah, they each were
I was wondering what foreign leader would speak at the current president's funeral when that happens someday.
Crown Prince.
And the only one that came to mind was, him or Putin.
So the thing that contradicts Justin a little bit, and because I did not like George W. Bush's presidency at all, but I found myself being sympathetic to George W. Bush this week. And so my sort of admonition to myself was to be more conscious of recognizing these people as whole people when they're in office and doing things I disagree with. Now, I don't think I'm going to be able to do that.
On Cochran's show this week, I mean, the 2-3 shows before, the state funeral, there's a level of respect for the dead and for someone who gave their life and was a public servant. You understand that. So we're not, I think it's right now is the appropriate time to bring up that it wasn't all, sunshine and roses with H.W. Bush. There's a lot of things, especially when you come to minority groups in this country, that they don't have this sterling, view of President Bush and what he accomplished in the late 80s. They just don't.
He was opposed to the Civil Rights Act, apparently, back in the 60s.
But he brought us the ADA, too.
Bring us the ADA. I mean, everyone's going to be a mixed bag. It does make you wonder, though, what is Trump's funeral going to be like? What are people going to say about him? Honestly, I mean, when you get up and talk at a funeral, you're not going to rip the guy. But what's the media commentary going to be like outside of the Fox News bubble? I mean, when you talk about what this guy has done to American democracy.
You think his presidency's not over.
I've thought about that, too, Eric. I haven't expressed it on the radio because it seems almost inappropriate. But if you think it's hard to manage George Bush's funeral, imagine how hard decorum is going to be to find when the current president dies.
I want to resist anything about Donald Trump, and this is not about, we've made everything about Donald Trump, and I just don't think this should be about Donald Trump.
Oh, so you don't want to talk about the fact that he didn't do the Apostles' Creed with everybody else in the church?
I didn't know that. No, I don't care.
That's blowing up on Twitter today.
The point is, too, Donald Trump's funeral may well be 28 years from now, like George Herbert Walker Bush's was, and it could be a very different situation.
I will say, I saw it on Twitter. It's great, this idea that all of the counterculture art that was created during H.W. Bush's tenure. Nirvana and Nevermind and
you're still
Dr.
going
Dre.
There, aren't you? Okay.
No, I just said there was a counterculture moment in America, and the president who represented the culture and the power was H.W. Bush. It's interesting to see.
Don't forget Homer Simpson.
Yeah, they all came out of all the things that are known to be iconic American counterculture programming. A lot of it started. The Colonel started during the Bush administration.
The president went mano a mano with Homer Simpson. You don't remember that?
I don't know what you guys are talking about.
Bad family values.
Simpsons first came out, it's not good.
That wasn't. I was thinking Dan Quayle. The vice president went mano a womanano with Murphy Brown.
Right.
Yeah. Right. So it was a transition. Clay Jenkinson, the presidential scholar who actually received a Humanities Award from President Bush, came on my show that next day and talked a little bit about his legacy and brought up some of the things you guys said, like, okay, there is Willie Horton. There are some of these issues. He was a transitional figure. He had a foot in both camps. He was from the greatest generation. He was the youngest naval aviator in World War II. I find those kinds of stories really compelling. Yeah. But you also saw the attack ads. You also saw,
He's the one guy that I would say you can't argue with his credentials to be president. And
oh,
you can
my
argue
gosh,
with
yeah.
Donald Trump's credentials, and you can argue even with Barack Obama's sure. credentials. He's a one-time senator. You almost go harken back to a time when this was the course to become an American leader, is you had to have all these things on your resume.
And now Beto O'Rourke's going to win with only a few terms in Congress.
Let's talk briefly about what's happened in Michigan and Wisconsin this week, since we're just doing some political talk here. And, Steve, this is something that you have been reporting on the radio. Maybe you guys have been talking about it as well. Maybe you should start with what happened in Wisconsin.
So in Wisconsin, the Democrats swept the statewide offices. I believe it was a sweep. They took the attorney general seat from a Republican. They defeated Republican Governor Scott Walker. The legislature, largely because of Illinois' gerrymandered, but largely because of the Republican gerrymandering up there, the legislature I think will hold. But in this lame duck session, the Republican legislature has passed a series of bills to weaken the incoming attorney general and the incoming governor. And Governor Walker indicates that he's going to sign it. It's devoid of dignity, I think. And they're doing the same thing in Michigan, where the Democrats. Well, in some other ways, they're lessening the power, I think, of the attorney general, too, in Michigan. In Michigan, there was a movement to increase the minimum wage and to increase paid sick leave. They were going to be on the ballot in referendum. So instead, the legislature in Michigan passed a law. The governor signed it saying, you know, no, we'll do it ourselves. So they took the issues off the ballot. And now that the election is over, they're weakening the legislation that they passed.
Now they're pulling the rug out.
Okay, so Eric, I have people text in this morning saying, oh, they do this all the time. This is, you're only because it's happening to Democrats that you care about.
They don't do this all the time. They did it in North Carolina in 2016. The North Carolina Republicans did a very similar move there. But this is not common, and I've pointed this out to people that Mike Madigan, no matter how, you know, everyone thinks he's the most evil guy in the universe, the most Machiavellian politician, he didn't do this to Governor Rauner, and he easily could have. They could have, I mean, the Democrats had suffocating majorities in the General Assembly.
Oh, that's right.
And they had the governorship as soon as Pat Quinn lost.
Right.
They could have gone in. They could have totally defanged.
You think somewhere Madigan's going,
governor.
Darn, I should have thought of
well,
that one.
And I might, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think a president will do things to try to make his moves more permanent after the election. I think Obama did that with some, I don't remember the specifics of it. So I kind of understand in Wisconsin, they moved to require that the state stay in the lawsuit against the health care reform. That's about policy. I kind of get that. But most of what they're doing...
They lost. They
but
were...
most of what they're doing is limiting the incoming governor's power, not about a specific
What's
policy.
What's the matter, Eric?
They fired... The voters of Wisconsin fired Scott Walker. They should march him out of the Capitol after he's fired, the way they do every employee who's fired.
He was booed
in America.
He was booed as he lit the Christmas tree in the Capitol.
And
this
not
week.
Let him sign legislation, yeah. Which is what's happening here in this lame
duck
session.
Well, if I can quote the governor of Wisconsin, the term doesn't end on election day.
It should.
Still,
I'm
I know.
Saying
well,
it
you
should.
Think about that. And does this remind you at all of what happened with Barack Obama's Supreme Court pick? In that, you know, they
well,
said
yeah,
we're just going to.
But you're making the other argument, though, because they were arguing that the president's term should end when it comes to naming Supreme Court justices.
Well, right. Before his term actually ended.
Right.
I mean, not even before even the election was held. I mean, yeah,
I just wonder about consistency, different. John, right? It shouldn't be where the rules change in the middle of a game. And I think as voters, I don't live in the state of Wisconsin or in Michigan, but I would just think that you almost can't even... I don't know. I can't even wrap my head
just
around
imagine
it.
How the, that's it's what so, I said. It's the, they use the word devoid, phrase devoid of dig. They, just it's so undignified to do something like that and to, well, you know, hopefully underestimate the voters that they're
well,
going to forget
it.
This in 2 years.
It's so transparent, and yet you wonder if it won't boomerang. And this reminds
I
me
I
of
doubt
what,
it.
Here's what happened in Minnesota. It was against the law for gays to marry. In an off-year election. The Republicans didn't know how they were going to get people to the polls. And so even though marriage was defined as that between a man and a woman, they said, let's make it a ballot referendum that the law can't change.
All right.
So they went ahead and put that on there. Well, the backlash was incredible. You had a law that said that marriage is defined as that between a man and a woman. And the Republicans, in order to get people out, said, let's double down on that. And not only did that
measure fail, but then the Democrats came in and they actually got the law
got
changed.
So,
I mean, that's how you got gay marriage, was them getting greedy.
Well, that's an interesting point, although, you know, there were elections, like I think the midterm election in 2004, where Republicans all over the country put anti-gay marriage referenda on the ballot.
It was the presidential election because it was a, right. it was a strategy by Karl Rove to help get George Bush reelected.
And it arguably worked.
Yeah.
He was reelected, and they, I think they juiced turnout in places like Ohio.
What else should we talk about here?
I'm always up for talking Chicago mayor.
Yes, let's do the mayors. Let's do
love
the mayors.
I am so into it.
You have dreams about this, don't you?
Soap opera.
And now you got to vote for Jeremiah Joyce because he's the top guy on the
ballot. I didn't even think about Joyce, the Joyce family. Jeremiah Joyce, what we were talking about today, his dad, Jeremiah Joyce's dad was, I mean, they're like this with the Daley family, right? I mean, this idea that the Joyce family worked for Daley and had a stake in Navy Pier. There's all sorts of ties. So the idea that two of these names are going at each other for mayor, that just adds to the fact we haven't even talked about Chico and Vallis. Come on!
All right, so Joyce then, and Joyce is in the news this week because they had a lottery, a drawing.
Yeah,
right?
He's number one.
He's top,
top
of the bat. Yeah. So
how about Preckwinkel challenging Mendoza's signatures?
Well,
we
challenging,
like that move?
She's challenging everybody's, right? A lot of the top challengers she's going after.
Only minority women. That's what's been called out.
Oh.
She did not go after the white dudes. Well,
how significant is your name being on the top of the ballot for Mr. Joyce?
A lot of people are busy, John.
They say that political scientists have studied this, and they say it's like it is a significant advantage, like 10% or something like that. I mean, obviously, with a field this big, it's not going to be 10%, but it actually does help. And I'm thinking, like, who is the numbnut who drags himself or herself out of the house to go vote and then can't look past the first name on the ballot?
I don't know. Have you voted for judges in Cook County? Yeah. I mean, do you know those names?
That's totally different. First of all, one thing that's interesting that happened is happening today on Thursday is the Chicago Teachers Union is coming out and endorsing Toni Preckwinkel, which is a big deal. There's a lot
surprising
of teachers.
Surprising to me.
So she's coming out. I am wondering about Mendoza's signatures. I mean, she turned in twice which is necessary. You're supposed to do three times. It was strange to me that she didn't turn in more. Amara Enya turned in like four or five times, and she did not get challenged.
Susanna Mendoza did that weird dance where she wasn't going to run for mayor till she was elected comptroller, and that set her back because the deadline for petitions was.
But weren't they
out
collecting anyway?
I don't know. I mean, to only come into. I know it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous in the beginning.
You need
12,500.
But why do we?
12,500.
Is there an alternative to collecting signatures?
Yeah,
anyway?
I'm with you, Steve.
What's
this sounds antiquated to me.
And I know
it is antiquated. And David Orr
wants
to incumbents.
David
Orr
wants to limit it.
You could buy your way onto the ballot. Would that be better? Because the alternative would be to have one of these bedsheet ballots like they have. I think it's in New Hampshire where you can just like sign up and get on the ballot.
Up,
and there's like 150 candidates. I mean, I don't think that serves the voters. There ought to be some winnowing process.
Well, we were talking about today. I mean, the state of Illinois for governor, I think it's 5,000 signatures. For mayor of Chicago, it's 12,500. And you just wonder, why is it so high?
The idea behind signature petition things like this is to show that you are serious, that you are actually, and you're organized. It is like the first test you have to pass, which is like you need to have enough of a commitment to go out and get those signatures and to make sure that they're okay. And that's sort of the baseline. If you just want to sit at home and like submit your name, be on the ballot, that's not enough. They want to show some organization, some effort to get on the ballot. That's
I wonder if you should
idea.
Be able to click, you know, instead of going door to door. I wonder if there ought to be a way to do it online.
Well, one thing that I don't care for is the idea that you can only sign one petition for one candidate. And, you know, I would like to see, I don't want to just see one candidate on the ballot. And so I don't understand why I should be limited
to signing. I've signed several and have been told by Patty Vasquez that I've now
ruined
my name.
You might be the one who keeps Mendoza off the ballot.
Here's a thought. I was thinking about this, that you have Rahm Emanuel, who only served two terms. I know it's ridiculous to say only serve, but in Chicago, that's a small. But, you know, I wonder if that changes the way voters approach this. When you have 21 candidates and you might want to go for someone that you might think might be niche, maybe they're not, you no longer have to think of them as like the kingmaker. You could say, well, let's try this point of view. Let's try this person because it's only going to be a one-term
or a
two-term.
Has that ever happened nationally?
I don't know.
Just give a fly?
But I wonder if it'll change the way people look at this election, that you're no longer looking for a made Chicago machine type person who's going to represent the city for the next 25 years.
I'm going to ask you about a different Chicago topic. It's a little late in the week cycle, but what is the thinking on the Cubs offering a contract to Addison Russell?
Well, they have shown The Chicago Cubs organization, the Ricketts family, have shown that they don't give two craps about that. Because they gave a contract to Aroldis Chapman. They traded for Aroldis Chapman, who was serving a suspension for domestic violence, you know, shooting a gun off. And he became, he was on the mound in the World Series in the Game 7. Gave up the home run. But the point being, he was a big part. Then they went out just in this offseason and got Daniel Murphy. Daniel Murphy is on the record saying he doesn't believe in the homosexual lifestyle or whatever, however he said it.
Yeah,
but, it. I mean, they don't seem to equate, whether it's Theo Epstein or the Ricketts, they don't seem to
I wouldn't equate
care.
Those two, though.
No, but, I mean, that's two players that, you know, they said, we don't care what you do off the field as long
you guys,
as you perform. Well,
you guys, can I just say, Sox fan.
It's true.
He's a Sox
true.
Fan.
Oh, my God. Yeah, we need to preface our comments on this based on whose team you root for.
That changes everything. Observer. I'm an observer of the Cubs.
Yeah. It's an interesting question to my mind about what kind of a penalty should apply to someone who does something like this. Is it a lifetime penalty? Because there's certainly... It is distasteful to think about Addison Russell coming back and playing for the Cubs after what he allegedly did. I don't think it's been proven, has it? They just, I mean, not in court or anything.
Well, he's admitted and apologized for it.
But so the question is it a lifetime ban? How long should someone have to sit out? Because we believe in second chances in this country for things that aren't murder or something like that. So that you know, it would seem to me that maybe, I mean, it's about half 40 games or 80 games. What did he get for that?
I don't remember. It was a long time.
But what about the Kansas City Chiefs running back? Kareem Hunt gets on video pushing and kicking the woman. And the Chiefs released that dude in 2 days. He's a Pro Bowler. It's not like he's just a guy.
Oh, he's amazing.
They chose the domestic part of it over what you do on the field, where I'm not sure the Cubs look at the same.
Well, you know what Mark Harmon said? It's a good thing for Addison Russell or the Cubs that we don't have video, because when I saw the Kareem video, it sure wasn't Ray Rice, right? I mean, I was expecting to see some all-out assault. Doesn't that sound
terrible?
You're
going to regret that, yeah.
Well, it is, what I said is true.
I know.
The question is, how do these things all line up and compare? And I don't know what Addison Russell did per se, but if we had video of it, I think this whole conversation
would change. And you know, that's all public. But the problem
is...
If I walk down the street
and randomly punch a guy, and then randomly punch a girl, woman, is it the same crime? It is the same crime, isn't it?
It is probably the same crime.
I have not come to a resolution on this. I have not sorted it out for myself. I know that if there's video of that Kansas City Chief guy, and this was a girlfriend, so spousal or...
It was just a random girl? It was a
19-year-old.
If it was a boy, a young boy, he would not have been caught.
Right. Well, there's a question. I mean, the Chiefs are saying that Kareem Hunt wasn't truthful about it. That's like they asked him about it. They had an investigation. He said no, it didn't happen. Then the video surfaced, and it did, and they caught him. Addison Russell, you don't know if he went to the Cubs and said, "Hey, this happened."
I think he was denying it publicly, at least.
I don't know.
Yeah, what do you make of that? So it's not the embarrassment or the video.
Yeah.
It's the fact that he wasn't honest with the organization.
Yeah,
we can't tolerate that. So our very good running back on this promising team is off.
So what should happen to Kareem Hunt? Should he be out of football forever?
No, I think he will get whatever they consider to be. And it's just the issue with Kareem Hunt is that he was not charged. There is no charge. There is no actual assault charge on him. So the NFL is acting, and the Kansas City Chiefs are acting as the police in this case.
The NFL is the worst investigative body in the history of the universe.
Maybe they know that, so maybe it's not a knee jerk, but they want to send a message, and that's what Roger Goodell, as the NFL commissioner, said early on. He's like, "We're not. It's a zero tolerance league, so it doesn't matter if a police." So with Addison Russell, was there a charge on him? Did he get
no? Charged? I don't think there was ever a police complaint.
Not a police complaint.
It came from his wife's blog.
But you know what happens then, as you say,
a friend of his wife's posted on Instagram. Yeah. I think
if the high road is okay, we're going to dismiss this player because we don't tolerate that. But a fair handling of that is to give people a second chance, like Eric says. So what you really do is you hand off that player to somebody else, and you may regret that from a baseball standpoint. The same way the Kansas City Chiefs, if they lose this guy because we can't have that, and the Bears need a running back, we'll say, well, we're going to help this young man write his life, and by golly, he can rush for 1,000 yards.
The Washington Redskins just picked up Reuben Foster, who's a linebacker who played at Alabama, who was a number one pick. He was on the San Francisco 49ers, and he's already on his second domestic abuse charge? I think it's a charge,
so,
straight up.
So at some point, I think you draw a line.
So the Niners released him, and the Redskins just picked him up the Flyers. Well, so it does go organization by organization.
Are we dealing with this, though, in a lot of these Me Too cases, too? Like Louis C.K. Does Louis C.K. get a chance to come back? If so, under what circumstances? Garrison Keillor, Al Franken, all these people who have been, I mean, and those are, you know, a range of severity. Does Harvey Weinstein, is he forever?
I don't know, but Les Moonves does not get $120 million in my world. Oh, my God.
But there is like this weird cultural dance that we do. Like, okay, the team who he plays for when he assaults has to get rid of him.
Right.
And then that opens him up for all the other teams. I mean, that's not a solution either.
I don't know, as a baseball fan and a Chicago fan, it's going to be hard to root for Addison Russell. I'm going to be honest with you. And I'm not a Cubs fan, so it's not that, you know, I would rather talk
I'll
to the Cubs fans in the room.
300.
I thought that way, too, when they had Dale Murphy, and then when he got up to bat in critical situations,
You're rooting for him.
I set aside
I didn't think about Aroldis Chapman
about
when he was on the mound in 2016. I mean, I was aware of it, but I was hoping that 104-mile-an-hour fastball went over the plate. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, I think
you just felt bad about yourself afterwards.
We like Dennis Rodman, okay, when he was playing with Michael Jordan. We hated him when he was with the Pistons. Are you guys at all interested in the controversy over Baby It's Cold Outside?
I don't even know what the controversy is, because this has been something that any intellectually minded person knows that this has been a poor song for the last decade. This argument's already been out there.
It's
so the idea
rapey.
It is, and everybody knows that. So the idea that we're now attributing it to the Me Too is disingenuous to
me. So you're saying it should not be played, that it's
it shouldn't be played. I think it's an offensive song. Everyone who knows that, and
what
I
makes
know
it
that,
offensive?
I felt it was offensive because she wants to leave in the song, and he's like, no, you can't leave.
Yeah.
But that's before a Me Too movement. That's just...
Well, I don't agree with you, except for the one line that I didn't know about where she says, what's in this drink? Okay, that's a problem. That's a big problem.
It's saying so lovely.
Justin, if Ruthie. That is not in that... If aside that line aside, and I say this, people look at me with... you could argue she's got all the power in that song.
Okay.
Would you please stay? I don't know if I want to stay. Okay. Would you please stay?
I don't have
she
a problem
has
with...
all the power.
I don't have a problem with... I guess the idea that they're not playing the song, but as a consumer, I've already made up my mind on that song. I think that song is dumb. I think it's an offensive song, and I don't play it in my house, and I don't there might be others that do. So
we're on the air here, and then someone did a bump for Santa Baby, and they said, well, what do you think of that song? And the woman on the air said, well, what's wrong with a woman hitting on a guy? You know, as if that's okay. But it's the same sort of reversed message.
When I play the James Taylor version of that this week, it sounds sweet. And when I play the Louis Armstrong version of it, it sounds predatory. I think it depends on how that song is almost performed.
I think in the end, if you hear that song, it's going to be up to her whether she stays or goes.
I am amazed that you think she has the power in that scene.
Yeah, well, just listen. Try to listen to it that way. He's trying to persuade her, and she's going to make the decision.
Let me put it. I don't understand the outrage, because this story to me just gets dredged up every year. It's something we've been talking about for 10 years, 20 years,
2 years. I've only been having this conversation. I've only been annoying my audience with this.
What is Starbucks doing with their cups this year? Can we talk about that?
Well, there's always a controversy.
Wait a minute. Rob Sherman is gone. We don't have the lawsuits anymore. There's got to be something.
This is not a beloved song, is it? I mean, in terms of canon, it's not one of the... It's not like they saying, oh, you can't do Silent Night, you know? Baby would never be silent at night. That's an outrage. It doesn't seem like it's really striking at the heart of everyone's Christmas traditions. I mean, I'm like into Christmas music quite a bit, and this is not one of the ones, my go-to songs by any means. So I'm happy to see it go.
Can we do this in short order? Should the state allow the Satanists to put their display next to the Christian Christmas displays at the state rotunda? I guess the answer has to be yes.
And then the Hanukkah display, the menorahs
and
there.
And anybody else whose faith is recognized and does the paperwork, I mean...
They get the 12,000 signatures.
What about that, Mr. Outrage?
Yeah, I guess you do, right?
Yeah,
I guess
why not?
You do.
And just turn around and don't let it bother you, and then you win.
It's like the Packer fan. Do you see the story about the Packer fan? The Packer fan at Soldier Field, he's a season ticket holder. He goes down to the, I guess it's a points thing. You see this? It was in your paper.
Yeah.
This idea that he's a season ticket holder, but he's a Packer fan at Soldier Field. He gets, because he's a season ticket holder, he goes to the sideline for the pregame. He wears Packer garb. The team tells him he can't do that. that he gets escorted off the field, and I believe out of the stadium. And he sent a lawsuit saying, I can wear whatever I want. It doesn't matter. And the Bears say no. And I, as a hardcore Bears fan, and as much of a hardcore anti-Packers guy, he's got to be. You got to let him wear that.
Well, his argument also turns on the fact that Soldier Field is a publicly owned entity, which I think is kind of not correct because you can't just walk into Soldier Field. You got to have a ticket. So
but where are we that you can't wear the other team's?
I think the Bears
Packer,
have a,
what are you talking
the Bears
about?
Have a leg to stand on here. I think they do have a right to say you can't wear this on our sidelines. But they shouldn't exercise that.
But it's for 30 minutes before the game. It's not like the guy's like third down at 7, and they're showing Matt Nagy, and he's standing next to him going, "Go Packers!" You know, it's a who cares? I think it just
adds to the rivalry. I wanted to add about the Satanic Temple, Chicago, and their thing in the state. I was like, absolutely, they should be allowed if they're making the claim they want to be part of the religious seasonal display. But the great part about that story, supposed to symbolize knowledge. The spokesman for the Satan. His name is Lex Manticore.
That's great.
Which people on Twitter are saying, this sounds like one of these like generate your own porn names.
Lex Manticore. If you lined them all up and said, okay, this we have a
delivery
Christian here,
pizza.
We have a Jew, we have a whatever, pick the Satanist, I would say, do you have a Lex Manticore? That would have been my first guess.
So anyway, but yeah, they should absolutely be able to have that display.
We are out of time today, guys. It's nice to have Steve Bertrand here. Sorry that Patty couldn't join us. It would have been interesting to have a woman's perspective on this one this week. Justin, nice to have you in.
Always.
We do our recommendations at the end of the podcast each week. We did it at the beginning this week, but we are reserving Eric's for the end because that's where we normally put them, and we want you to be part of the recommendation part of the podcast as well. Something you're listening to, watching, reading, eating, drinking, anything you want to recommend, we want to know about it. Leave us a voice memo. You can also put it on our Facebook posts, and we'll read them there. But we'd like to hear your voice as we now hear Eric's.
This is Eric Zorn from the Northwest Side. My recommendation is The Day They Came for the Governor, a new article in Chicago Magazine in which the FBI agents who arrested Governor Rod Blagojevich in his home 10 years ago Sunday go minute by minute through that fateful morning, including the strange final question Blago asked as agents prepared to cuff him and lead him into the alley. How does my hair look? That's The Day They Came for the Governor in Chicago Magazine.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can also listen online at WGNradio.com. Plus, catch highlights every Saturday from 11 to 11:30 a.m. on The John Williams Show on WGN Radio.